May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be ever acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our redeemer.
Amen.
Please be seated. So in the office just before the service, talking to our lector and our altar service Judy and Jackie today, they both looked at me and said, thank God I don't have to preach today. Because that Genesis story, how about that Genesis story? One of your favorites, right? This Genesis story, this story of Abraham and the offering of his son Isaac, shows up in the lecture once every 3 years and on Easter Vigil. But it's okay, you can ignore it and choose something else on Easter Vigil. There is actually alternate choices, and it's always tempting to go, okay, never mind, this year we'll just take the other track so I don't have to deal with Abraham and Isaac. Because this is a hard story to make sense of. This is a story that we start out and we look at and we go, what am I supposed to do with this? How am I supposed to make sense of this story? But it is also a story that is at the heart of all three Abrahamic religions. It is a story that has been told by faithful Jews and wrestled with by the rabbis. It became a basis for Christians to understand the sacrifice of Christ. And it turns out the same story is in the Quran, although it's not Isaac but Ishmael who's laid on the altar there. This is a story that is important in our tradition. It's a story that we keep telling. And so I think we have to try and figure out how to read it, how to make sense of it, what to do with it. Because simply shoving it in the back of the book and ripping out the page isn't really adequate. And I think actually grappling with the story gives us an opportunity as we get into it. There's a lot here. In fact, there's so much here that I usually start with like 2.5 pages of notes as I start working on a sermon. I had like 12 of them by Thursday. And so I'm not going to tell you everything I've been thinking about this story. I'm going to invite you to come back during Lent, when we're going to do a special after Lenten series on the stories of Easter Vigil, and we're going to spend some real time unpacking it then. But here's what I'm thinking about it right now. First off, this is a story where context really, really, really matters. Because part of our reaction to this story is the notion of child sacrifice, the notion that you would take a child and lay them in an altar and offer them as birth sacrifice is just instantly abhorrent to us. It feels so obviously wrong to us. But this first story was first told by people who knew of that exact practice. If not within their own community, at least in lands around them, they've heard stories. 2 Kings talks about people sacrificing their children to Moloch, an idol. In Jeremiah, the prophet rails against the practice of child sacrifice. So while it's instantly abhorrent to us, it isn't as obviously so as we might think. It was not ridiculous or absurd to think that God or a God might demand the sacrifice of a child. So our instinctive reaction is actually shaped by our culture. And that instinctive reaction isn't necessarily instantly assumed. And that's led a number of people to suggest that, in fact, this is not a story about child sacrifice except to reject it. This is a story that offers a reason why Israel will not sacrifice children. I don't know if it was told for that original purpose, but it's almost certainly true that Israel, which rejected child sacrifice, certainly kept telling this story to demonstrate that their God did not ask that of them. That, in fact, that their God offered an alternative to the sacrifice of the firstborn. Everybody go back and check the law, because while the law says the firstborn does indeed belong to God, the law also says don't sacrifice them. Here are the other animals that are acceptable in the place of the firstborn son. So this story offers a context for why that would be the case for Israel, when it might for other people around them, for other stories that they have heard. Why they should not simply accept people come up and say, you know what the problem is, you're going to sacrifice your firstborn to end this drought. And Israel would say, uh-uh. So they would have heard this story a little differently than we do, without that first initial horror that anybody could ever suggest that God would demand a firstborn sacrifice. They would have heard it as Abraham does, as accepting that as something God's due, and it's not something to be obeyed until we get to the end of the story. It would have been a challenge to that assumption that, of course, this is the way God works. Context matters when we listen to these stories, especially because so many of them were told in times and places so different from our own. And once we kind of set aside that instinctive reaction of how could anybody think that God would ask this of them, and acknowledge that in fact that was people's experience, we're also invited in to think about the ways in which it's still true in the modern world. Because while we don't normally build altars of stone and suggest children should be given as burnt offerings in a temple, the simple fact is that we are surrounded by examples in the modern world in which children are still sacrificed in the name of God and in the name of our idols. In the name of war, and children who are bombed and who are subjected to chemical weapons because they belong to the wrong people. Children who are targeted. People who are extremists in Boko Haram in Nigeria kidnapping children. Rebel groups taking boys as young as 8 or 9 and turning them into soldiers. The Holocaust, in which Jewish children were herded into gas chambers. Attackers right here who choose schools as their target to make their point with a gun. It would be nice to think that this story has nothing at all to say to us because we no longer believe in child sacrifice. But if we are thoughtful and honest with ourselves, there is still something here to speak to us of God's will for the world. I think this story also makes us uncomfortable because, by and large, we don't like the idea of God demanding sacrifice at all. We don't like the idea that God could ever ask of us something that was more than we were willing to give. And yet, the Bible is quite clear in this story and many, many other stories. And in fact, the gospel from last week, that God, in his seeking of redemption for the whole world, often does ask of us much more than we are willing or want to give. That in fact, the sacrifice can be our own lives or the safety of our families and even our children. And we have that, we know that vision through the witness of the martyrs. There is a saint in the early church, Perpetua, who was one of the first women to write her story, and she was martyred in the Colosseum at Rome. And she writes about why she lets go of her infant son nursing, despite her father's pleading, to bear witness to the power of Christ. These are our forebears, the models for our faith. Abraham willing to sacrifice his son. Jesus willing to offer his own life. The martyrs willing to give themselves, regardless of the cost, to bear witness to the power of the resurrection. We don't like these stories because we are afraid we might be among those one day called to offer such a sacrifice. And that is not a comfortable thing to stare in the face of. It's much, much easier to turn the page and read a different story. And then there's Abraham's response. Because Abraham hears God's call and without answer simply sets out to obey. Now, if you read this story all by itself and you don't know any of the other stories about Abraham, you might assume that what's being held up here is the ideal is blind obedience without ever questioning what God says. But if you have read about Abraham, you know that's not Abraham at all. Abraham argues with God and wins. Abraham, frankly, has a track record of receiving promises of God saying, okay, I'll trust you only so far, and then reminding God that the promise hasn't been fulfilled yet, and when are you going to get around to that, Lord? Abraham is not a guy who, hearing a voice from God, says, okie dokie, and just heads off and does it. And yet, he does in this story. And I think asking why is really important. And part of the answer is because this story does not simply come because God one day spoke to Abraham out of the blue and Abraham instantly responded. It's because Abraham and God go back a long, long way. They have had many, many, many times together. And Abraham, in that deep and intimate relationship, has learned that God has always been trustworthy. Even when it seemed utterly and completely impossible, that whole son by Sarah thing, Abraham has discovered that God can pull off what God has promised. So Abraham's response here isn't a casual response. It's a response of trust that no matter how impossible this seems, no matter how completely counterintuitive and ridiculous and indeed breaking of God's promise this seems, somehow it's going to come out okay, because God had promised Isaac would be the source of Abraham's descendants, and Abraham has no idea how he could sacrifice Isaac and that could still happen, but he figures God does. That kind of trust does not emerge from a quick confession of faith. That kind of trust can only emerge from an entire lifetime spent in relationship, in questioning, in conversation, in walking with God through terrible times and through joyous ones, until the trust is so strong that Abraham can believe that God knows what he's doing even in this moment. And none of that is intended to make this a nice and happy story that's easy to accept or should be read without questions. In fact, I think the whole reason we should tell this story is because it makes us ask questions. It makes us say, what on earth are you thinking of, God? What? This doesn't fit my idea of what God is like. I've always known God this way. How can this story be about the same God that I have known through other stories, through worship, through praise, through the good times in my life, and through the bad? I think the very reason to tell this story is because it's not easy. Because it doesn't offer us a simple answer about who God is or what our relationship with him is or even about what Abraham ought to have done. I think we can legitimately look and go, Abraham, why didn't you ask questions here? You did earlier. I think we can be appalled by the idea that Abraham would so readily consider sacrificing his son. I think we can, in fact, should come and ask the questions that this story raises, and there are so many of them. Because this is not a simple story. This is not a simple set of introductions, a simple set of rules about who God is. This is not an easy story. And that's exactly why we should keep telling it. Amen.